The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
When you turn on the evening news, do you see what you want to see or what you need to see? Welcome to Bread for the Journey, ordinary people doing extraordinary deeds with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. It seems like more often than not, the good news and people that are making it are buried into a two-minute feature piece near the end of the report. What about giving these people and this kind of news a full hour every week? Now, here's your host, Mariana Cacciatore.
Good morning, and this is Mariana Cacciatore. Welcome to our show today. Hope you enjoy it. Today's going to be a little bit different. Rather than interviewing someone, I'm going to talk about the book that I've written, a book called Being There for Someone in Grief. You know, it's a story that can be a little bit difficult to hear, and I'd like to, and it, you know, grows and it ends well. I'm here to tell the story. But I'd like to begin with a quote, sort of an uplifting quote that is from Barbara Kingsolver in Animal Dreams to help sort of begin to frame the whole picture, the big picture. This is from, again, Barbara Kingsolver from her book Animal Dreams. She says, "Here is what I've decided. The very least you can do in your life is figure out what you hope for. And the most you can do is live inside that hope. Not admire it from a distance, but live it right in it, under its roof. What I want is so simple, I almost can't say it. Elementary kindness. Enough to eat, enough to go around. The possibility that kids might one day grow up to be neither the destroyers nor the destroyed. That's about it. Right now, I'm living in that hope, running down its hallways and touching the walls on both sides." So my story begins at a, you know, in my childhood where there was a murder, and much of my life story was centered around that grief. And when I was able to move completely through it and out of it, I came to work at Bread for the Journey International, the nonprofit that's focused on generosity and kindness. And I'm going to read one more quote before I actually begin my story. And this was written by Bread for the Journey's founder, Wayne Muller. And once again, it's in the same way that Barbara Kingsolver's little piece here about elementary kindness frames the story I'm about to share with you, so does this really beautiful quote by Wayne Muller from his book, How Then Shall We Live? It begins here. "Thus our sorrow becomes our gift. From within our tender hurt, there can spring kindness, generosity, and a love for others. In our grief and confusion, we may mistakenly believe we have no offering to bring the family of the earth. But mere suffering cannot extinguish the priceless gift of our true nature. As soon as we begin to heal, the instant we experience some degree of inner clarity or spaciousness, in the very next breath, generosity naturally arises. As we feel the measure of our own strength, we simultaneously experience a natural impulse to share it. This is not faith. This is simple spiritual physics. As we are fed, so do we wish to feed others." And that's exactly what happened, as you will hear. So my story begins in December of 1965. It was the eve of the winter solstice, the longest night of the year. I was thrust into the world of grief and loss as a child of 11. My best friend was kidnapped. It was a long night that stretched into 2 months. And it was on Valentine's Day in 1966 that we learned they found her dismembered and her burned body. You know, the phrases death and dying and grief and loss are common today, but 45 years ago they weren't. And even though they are phrases that are current today, we still, as a species, haven't caught up with this idea of grief is something that that is really okay to feel. We seem to be a species that wants to, and it's natural, I understand it, we want to jump over that pain or move away from that pain, or we have some kind of shame about that pain. But it was even more pronounced in, you know, as far back as 1965 when I was a child, because nobody even spoke the words grief and loss. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Stephen Levine, who have done so much work in the area of grief and loss, weren't really even on the scene much yet. And so grief, if it was expressed at all, was done privately behind closed doors. But you can imagine, Susan was my best friend. She, in some ways, I like to say she was my twin sister of a separate mother. The day we met, we became sort of connected at the hip, and we spent the next 3 years doing everything we could in every free moment that we had together. And so to have her so suddenly gone, and then, of course, the trauma of a kidnapping and being gone for 2 months, and then of, you know, and then finding her body murdered and dismembered and burned. You can imagine the trauma that I experienced as a child. I was pretty hysterical inside, but as I looked around, I really didn't see anybody who looked even close to the way I was feeling. And so as a child, and this is very common thing that children do, you know, they think it's about them. They think I thought there was something wrong with me. And so I did everything I could to hide what I was feeling from my parents, my teachers, and my friends. I thought everyone would think I was crazy, and I was too invested in not looking crazy to be honest with anybody about what was going on. But just beneath the surface, you know, that grief was growing. And finally, when I was 25 years old, now that's 11, you can imagine I went all the way through my teen years with this. I was getting into a lot of trouble. Then as I got a little older, you know, I was having trouble with relationships. And at 25 years old, a loss that I initiated triggered me remembering Susan and the whole murder. I began dreaming of her every night. I'd hear her voice saying to me, everything is going to be okay. And I'd wake up from these dreams, and it was unmistakable. It was Susan's voice. And so I began to, I asked my mom, called her on the phone and asked if there was a photograph of Susan. And my mom sent it to me, and thus began the journey of piecing back together what happened when I was 11 years old. And of course that took me into, you know, therapy, and I spent years unraveling the layers of sorrow that covered the really big one that happened when I was a child. So years later, this was in 1988, I emerged from therapy and decided what I wanted to do was to create a support center for children and their parents or the adults connected to them who were grieving. I wanted a place in my community where people could grieve as close to the time of the death as possible. I wanted a place where parents could get some support for what they were going through. Often, you know, their parents had had a child die in the family and there were other children still alive, or a parent that had a spouse die and they had young children in the family that needed support. And so I wanted a place where parents could have someone to talk to as well, so that everybody in the family system was supported around this idea that grief is a natural reaction to a loss, and they would have no reason to feel the need, no logical reason anyway, to feel the need to hold that grief inside, but rather find some very kind and gentle ways for little by little to let that grief express itself so that nobody had to carry it around for years and years. And so I pulled together some volunteers and I brought in some trainers. I found a program in Portland, Oregon that's still there today called the Dougie Center. They were the first organization in the country, I believe, that was doing this kind of support work with children in grief. And I went up there and I volunteered and learned everything I could about their center and came back and replicated it in Tucson, Arizona. And today that organization has grown. The Children to Children program is it's their biggest major program, but the large program today is called Tunidito, which means your little nest. And if you're ever in Tucson, Arizona, you should look them up. They'd be happy to give you a tour of the facility and show you the depth of the work that they're doing today. I serve as an emeritus lifetime board member with them, and I'm so proud of that work. So after founding Children to Children and running support groups and serving as its executive director for many years, one of the things that I noticed was that the adults, I often facilitated adult support groups there, and the thing that adults were often saying to me was that that they had lots of people in their life who knew them and loved them and cared for them, but few people in their life who could support them in the way that we were doing it in this support center. So in other words, they had loved ones who really wanted to be there for them, but just didn't have the skill sets to be able to do it well. They'd often give advice and interrupt when people were talking or be very uncomfortable with tears. There's a whole range of things that happens with people when we're around. It's common. I mean, it's understandable. You know, you get around somebody who's grieving and you begin to notice your own heart rate going up. You're nervous and anxious and there's some part of you that's saying you need to say just the right thing to make it all okay, or to somehow something, or to believe that somehow you said something that made them cry. And we don't know how to be with people in grief. And so over the years, I heard that so many times that at one point I just stopped and said, you know, one day I'm going to sit down and write a book for lay people, for everyday people, for ordinary people, a simple book that's not a big, thick, 300-page book, but one that can be read fairly quickly and easily, that will give them some tools and guidelines for how to be with people in grief in a way that's welcomed, in a way that's respectful and kind. And so I did. I sat down and I spent a few years working on this, and the book is here today. It's called Being There for Someone in Grief. And today, in the rest of the interview, or the rest of this hour, I'm going to talk about an acronym that I used in the book, SALT, S-A-L-T, as in the salt of tears, to help frame the book and teach four simple skills that aren't always easy, but are very simple. They're to remember at a time when you're in stress and you're with somebody in grief. If you go back to the acronym of SALT and learn it well, you can remember what it is that you can do. And today I'm going to go through each one of them and share what they mean and help you a little bit in how to be with somebody in grief. One of the great truths I have learned in this lifetime is that given any safe and nurturing environment, humans naturally gravitate in a direction of healing. So the question really then becomes, how do we create that safe and nurturing environment? How can we be a soft place for hard things to land? What does safe mean? And so SALT, S-A-L-T, was the acronym that I came up with to help answer that question in the simplest way possible. So S in SALT is for seeing a person just as they are, to simply see them. There's a for one who is grieving, being seen somehow makes their experience more complete. There's like a critical feedback loop that's completed when someone bears witness to our sorrow. This being seen, I believe, is what's missing for prisoners in solitary confinement. That's the reason solitary confinement, in my view, is so punishing. We as human beings need to be seen. I often say that we have everything within us that we need to heal, except a friend who can see us as we truly are. And so our job, if we really want to provide some kind of comfort to someone we know who might be grieving, it doesn't necessarily have to be a death. It can be a loss from divorce. There are all kinds of losses that put us in this place of vulnerability. And the first thing that you can do if you are somebody who wants to be a soft place for that person to land is to see them just as they are. So I want to share a story with you to help illustrate this. This is a story that was told to me by my teacher, one of my many teachers that helped me learn about how to be with people in grief, Izetta Smith. She is the woman at the Dougie Center, the program director there, who created the program in the way that we used it at Children to Children. So she tells a story about when she was running a children's support group and there was a young girl who came into the program. She was somewhere in the area of 8, 9, 10 years old. And she had been in a car accident with her mother and her father and her sister, who was very close in age to her, and she was the only survivor of that accident. So she was being raised by a grandmother, and she had lost her desire to really live. She wasn't eating, and she was sort of floundering at school, and she'd lost weight, and she was growing very pale, and she'd come to this support center, and what Izetta noticed one day when all the kids were in one room is that she had sort of slipped out of the room. And Izetta quietly kind of followed her and found her in one of the other rooms at the Dougie Center dancing. She was in an empty room, and there was a large mirror in the room, and she was dancing in front of the mirror. And Izetta sort of quietly slipped in, sat down in a corner of the room, and the girl turned around and saw her, stopped for one moment, didn't say a word, but then continued to dance. And when she was done dancing, she just came over to Izetta, looked her in the eye, and walked out of the room. Again, no words were spoken. The following week, when the young girl came back, after the pre-group was completed, she walked over to Izetta, took her hand, brought her into the room that they were in before, pointed to where she wanted Izetta to sit, and then she went over to the mirror and began to dance, this time a little more feverishly, a little wilder, with a little more abandon. And when she was done, she walked over to Izetta, looked at her, and then walked out of the room. And this is how it went for several sessions, week after week, each time getting more intense in her dance, but no words were ever spoken. And one day, on their way out at the end of the evening, the grandmother, who was now raising this young girl, approached Izetta and said to her, "I don't know what you're doing up there, but it's really working. Things have turned around for her. She's eating again. She's got color in her face. She's investing in school." And this is such, to me, is such a perfect, perfect example of the power of simply being seen. Had Izetta even tried to engage her in conversation, it might have stopped the whole process. There were no words involved at all. The power of being seen. So with that, I would like to break for a moment before we go on to the acronym letters ALT in SALT. We'll take a break and we'll come back in a few moments. Thank you very much.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
Hi, this is Mitchell John. I'd like to welcome all of you to our new show, Mornings with Mitchell John. Our show will air weekdays, 6 a.m. Pacific, across the networks of Voice America and World Talk Radio and their family channels. Interviews, news, sports, weather, and of course, great music all the time. Come join us each morning for a great way to start your day.
Discover valuable solutions to your most important health challenges. Get started each week by tuning in to True Health Now Radio with Dr. John Hernandez. There are many root causes to ailments, from common ones to the most serious. You'll learn more about your body, nutrition, supplements, and prescription drugs, as well as natural alternatives for enriching your health and transforming your life. The result for you is a longer and stronger life. True Health Now Radio with Dr. John Hernandez can be heard every Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk. Yeah! If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
Welcome back, and if you've got any questions for me at any time, feel free to send them to me. I'll get back to you when I can. The mailing address is bfjradio@gmail.com, and I look forward to hearing from you. So the second letter in SALT is A, and A is for allowing a person to be just as they are. S was for seeing them just as they are, but we take it one step further and do our work inside to allow them to be just as they are. You know, I consciously chose the word allow over the word accept. Both of them start with an A. But I did this because most of us lay a trip on ourselves when we try to accept someone. But allow has a little more wiggle room. But the key message here is that the journey of grief is unique for each person. They are the ones going through something huge. And our job as companions, as friends, as lovers, even coworkers, I don't know what your relationship will be with the person who's grieving, but don't ever diminish the depth of that relationship and your power of to be somebody significant in their life, even if you just sit next to them in a work environment. Allow them as much as you possibly can the space to act out their sorrow in whatever way they need. If they're a family member, they may beg out of Christmas celebrations, a wedding anniversary party, a date you've had on the calendar for a while. They may need to sleep till noon or be up all night or eat very little or eat a lot. The work of allowing them to be as they are is yours to do. And it's not always easy work. And my experience has been that the closer the person is in your life, the harder this job is to do because we peg people. You know, we know what their triggers are. We know there are certain things that trigger us about their behavior. If it's somebody that's living in our house, their behavior really impacts us in a big way. If it's somebody that we work with all day long, often their behavior impacts our work. If they don't get something done, maybe it's a heavy workload for us. None of us are perfect. This is one of those things that I, in my estimation, is a lifetime worth of work. But I'd like to share a story with you of a difficult client that I had and what I creatively did to be able to get to a place, at least, you know, some of the time where I could allow her to be just as she is and I could stop the kind of judgments that were going on in my head. This was a woman who came to us and her husband had died. And she had a teenage daughter, and the evening that they arrived, I greeted them. I knew they were coming. They were new guests, and so I had my eye out for them. And so when they arrived, I came over and began talking to them, and I asked the teenager a few questions to try to engage her. And the mother would interrupt and answer the question for the teenager. And it happened 3 and 4 and 5 times. And pretty soon I was sort of getting this picture of who this person was, this mom. And I didn't like it. I didn't like the sound of her voice. I hated the way she interrupted her daughter, or answered questions for her daughter. And, you know, you could see the daughter diminishing every time it happened. And then, of course, I was facilitating an adult group, and she was in my adult group. And this was a group that had been growing in intimacy over several months. We had a very tight and beautiful group that, you know, week after week was doing some powerful work. And suddenly we had this woman in our group whose voice sounded to me like fingernails on a chalkboard. And she was interrupting people and she was giving advice. And, you know, the more I tried to outline what the guidelines of the group were to kind of manage her behavior, the more frustrated I got every time, you know, there was another moment when she interrupted somebody or gave advice or it was hard. It was hard. And so I did a lot of work outside of my support group that evening and all the subsequent evenings where this behavior repeated itself. I did a lot of work to be able to come to a place where I accepted her. And some of the work I was doing was around managing her behavior, doing what I could to manage her behavior. But a big part of this, I knew had to do with something in her that triggered something in me, and it was my work to do. So week after week, we did this work, and in post group, which is a place where all the volunteers and whatever staff was working that night could come together to debrief, I often used that time to process whatever I was struggling with her. And one night, I came home from my group, and I was... I was just having a really hard time that night, and I sort of tossed and turned as I went to sleep. And then I had a dream that night, and in the dream, I was troubled about something. And you could see this kind of pained look on my face. I was sort of crouched over, my head was looking down, and I was caught kind of like in a vortex of obsession about something that was really troubling me. And right in the middle of it, I heard to my right a tinkle, a sound of a bell or a chime or just the sweetest little, you know, ding. And I stopped for a moment. It caught me. And I just like turned to the right. What's that? And there within my view was the most beautiful vista you could imagine, with this gorgeous blue sky and these mountains and the sun shining down on these leaves and the trees just moving in the wind and catching the light. And it was breathtaking, awe-inspiring vision. And I heard a voice just at that moment that said, "In every moment, this also. In every moment, this also." And I thought, when I woke up from the dream, and I made a cup of tea, it was morning, made a cup of tea and began thinking about this dream, it occurred to me that in the moments when I'm really frustrated with this woman, when we're in a support group and I find myself in that moment again of being critical of her, that in that moment, there is another thing that can happen simultaneous to it, that I can be angry or frustrated with her and at the same time remember that there is a vista of beauty, or at the same time remember that I am completely at peace, that she is fine the way she is, that those two things don't have to be two different things happening at two different times, but they can happen simultaneously. And it was kind of remarkable, like with just a quarter turn, everything changed. So I sort of came up with this idea that below the building that we were in, that there was a river of acceptance or a river of allowing that was flowing in it. There was a current. And whenever we were in group and she would say something that would frustrate me, I could just sort of take it with my hands and place it in the river of acceptance and let it float downstream. And then, of course, there was this beautiful and gorgeous nature scene with this flowing river that I could remember was happening at the very same time. And in a flash of a moment, I was free from the tyranny that I was creating for myself of judgment and move into a place of acceptance. And it was a remarkable experience of freedom for me. And I applied it several times. A few weeks went by. It happened again and again. I was sharing it with my folks in post group afterwards. It was, you know, it was like this big new thing. I could hardly believe it. And then one evening, this woman approached me after support group and she said, "Can I speak with you?" And I said, "Sure." And I took her away into my office and we went and closed the door. And she looked at me and she said, "You know, I just want you to know that I am being more accepting of my daughter. I'm really allowing her to be just as she is without my judgment and criticism." And she said, "It's really changing our life. But the reason that I'm telling you about this is that I feel like I'm able to do this because I feel your acceptance of me." Of course I couldn't tell her all that I had been through to get to a place where I'd come up with this creative idea. And it wasn't as though I never felt critical or judgmental of her anymore. I just had a new tool that was helping me make a shift in that moment. But I'm sure my mouth dropped open. I was shocked at the idea that perhaps on some level she could feel my shift. Even though it wasn't a complete and total shift, even though I was still feeling, she could feel it enough that she could articulate it with me. She could feel it enough that she could begin to make a shift in her relationship with her daughter. And she said it was changing, actually, the dynamic between she and her daughter. So there was enough of a shift here that the daughter herself was feeling it and changing her relationship with her mother. So I think it's a very powerful story to tell. It's a very powerful story that changed my life. And I hope in telling it, it's something that you can use at some time in your life as well. So we still have two letters left in our acronym, L and T. And when we come back from our break, I'll speak to you about what they stand for. And I look forward to doing that. So stay tuned and come back. We'll see you in a few minutes.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
When it comes to youth and high school football, listen each week to Coach Al Gross at First and Ten Football. Coach covers vital topics relating to the latest trend on a national level. Join Coach as he interviews personalities from the NFL, NCAA, and the top high school coaches from around the country. Catch all the interviews and get in-depth information online at www.firstandtenfootball.com. Your national resource for youth and high school football. First and Ten Football airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Sports.
Each week, Jimmy Gould brings you the stories and the people that you want to hear about. Tune in to A Current Life to hear about the journey to success, how our guests became the people they are today, and the highs and lows they experienced along the way. Each hour will leave you inspired and entertained as Jimmy gets up close and personal with every week's guest and shares ideas you can identify with and apply to your own life. A Current Life with Jimmy Gould airs Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your questions. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com. You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
Welcome back. And I'm glad to have you. We're here talking about my book, Being There for Someone in Grief. And I am Mariana Cacciatore, host of the show Ordinary People, Extraordinary Deeds. So we were talking about an acronym, SALT, as in the salt of tears, for how helping us remember ways to be with someone in grief. And I just covered the letter S and the letter A. The third one is the letter L, and you can guess that L stands for listen. You know, this is an old adage, but it's so visual and helpful, I can't stop myself from repeating it. The reason we're created with two ears and one mouth is to help us remember to listen at least twice as often as we speak, that twice as much as we speak. There's a phrase I use often in the book called deep presence. Listening, as I'm referring to it, is much bigger than just listening. It's really about offering our deepest presence to someone. And it includes seeing the person just as they are, which is what the S stood for. And it includes allowing the person to be just as they are. But a very big dose of it, a very big piece of listening, is really the physical job of stopping yourself from speaking and in a moment, and allowing yourself to become comfortable with the silences that might occur between people, to learn to let silence be okay when two people are together. You know, we live in a world where something is filling the airwaves all the time, every moment of every day, and we really do. I mean, I think probably the only practices that help us learn this are meditation practices or any kind of practices of solitude. And we have to actually practice them to do it. And so I would like to share a story with you about a client that I had, again, at Children to Children. And I will reiterate that I have changed the names and some of the details of these stories to protect the people that I'm speaking of. And at this time when I had started Children to Children, I had been meditating for several years. So I had already had this practice of using my breath as a way to calm myself down, to slow my heart rate. And I would count my breaths, and slowly but surely I'd go into a deeper place, a deeper place of meditation. And so this was a practice that was, you know, common and comfortable. I spent 20, 30, 40 minutes every day meditating when I began Children to Children. And we had a client who came to Children to Children, who is a grandmother now of a granddaughter. She's now the grandmother's daughter had died, and the daughter had a daughter. And so this woman, who was now our client at Children to Children, was a new mother all over again in her late 60s to her granddaughter. And so most of the time when she came, she would often talk about this challenging new role. She had just gotten married a few years ago, and so she has this new husband, and all of a sudden they're parents in their late 60s. And, you know, so often she'd come and she'd talk about that, but this one particular night, you know, she came, and she was in a very pensive place. It was a little bit unusual for her, and she sat down, and she picked up the talking stick from the center of the coffee table. She wanted to speak. She wanted the floor. And so the rest of us all sort of got quiet and gave her the space. And within a few minutes, I could tell that she was needing to tell us the story of her daughter's slow death and the diminishing of her daughter's body in the process. And it was a painful story and difficult story to hear. And I remember at the beginning of it, this was early in my days as a facilitator, at the beginning of it, my heart started beating really fast, and I was thinking, oh my God, you know, she's really going to tell this very graphic tale. And my mind immediately went to, what are the things that I could say to help her feel better? And my training had been to not do that at all. My training had told me my job is to be still and silent and present, that she had everything within her that she needed to heal from this loss, and that my job was to create a safe container for her to take this trek. And if I successfully created this container, that she would feel safe enough to go to wherever she needed to go in this story, in this telling of this story, in this processing of her grief, to do the work she needed to do. So my job was to be still and silent and present, and to listen, to offer what I call our deepest presence. And yet my body was reacting very differently. My heart was beating fast. My mind was telling me that I needed to say just the right thing. And I was also, as a new facilitator, worried about all the other people in the circle. Could they hear this very difficult story? And it was clear that she was going to tell the whole story. And so she was taking a lot more time than generally one person in a circle would take in an evening. But at some point, something kicked in because of the years of practicing meditation. Something kicked in and I began deep breathing as a way to deal with my own anxiety. And it didn't take long. It was just a few minutes. And suddenly I began to feel my body completely relaxing. My shoulders were dropping. All the voices in my head that were telling me I needed to do something other than just listen and be present began to dissipate and fall away. And after a few more minutes of that, it occurred to me as I looked around the room that everybody in that circle wanted to be there in that moment, that we had all knew that this was a holy moment, if you will, and that we were giving her exactly what she needed, that it was as precious to all of us as listeners as it was to her as speaker for the evening. And then all of the thoughts in my head completely were gone at that point, and I stepped right into that place of giving her that place of deep presence. That place of deep presence. And so L is for listen. And that story is my story that I share with you to illustrate how it is we move from this place of anxiety to a place of really offering our deepest presence to somebody who needs, who has everything they need within them to heal, except someone who can offer their witness, someone who can bear witness. And that was our job for the evening. And that is your job the next time you're with somebody who you know is going through something. And then the last word the last letter in the word salt is T, and that is for trust. And the phrase I want to share with you is trust the process. This process that I have just explained to you. S is for seeing the person just as they are. A is for allowing the person to be just as they are. L is for listening to them just as they are. And if you can follow those guidelines, then the last thing that is like the bow on the package is to trust that process. And if you can trust that process, you will be amazed at what you'll be allowed to participate in people's lives. It's really about coming to believe in our gut that within us lies everything we need to heal. And so your trust becomes the safe container in which the person who's grieving can move freely. All you really need to know is that they have their own process and they will heal. Your job really is to become the student, allowing them to teach you about their journey. I would often say to people who are in the depths of grief and who don't believe they will ever emerge from it, that's okay. You know, you can be right where you are. I will hold the candle of faith for you when your faith is gone. I will keep it for you till you are ready to take it back. And this trust is something that, it really is something that develops over time. If you have an opportunity to become a volunteer in a center like Children to Children or Tuni Dito in Tucson, and there are centers like this now all over the country. If you go to the Dougie Center's website, that's like the little boy's name, Doug, D-O-U-G-Y. If you look them up on the web, Dougie Center in Portland, Oregon, they have a place on their site where you can plug in your zip code and they'll tell you what the centers are that are nearest. And like I said, the last I heard, there were something like 350 centers around the country that have replicated themselves after the Dougie Center. We were we and one in Cincinnati were the first two in the country that started. And that was way back in 1989. But now there are many. So you could, if there's something near you, I would encourage you to sign up as a volunteer, dedicate a year of your life, go through their training, and then actually get in there with people in grief and practice. And you will grow into this place of trusting by actually seeing family after family after family come through the program, come out of the program, and be better for it. So the last story that I want to share with you is one about a young man, a young boy whose name was Lance. He came to us, and this was a really such a difficult story. His mother had died. There was a car accident. His mother had died, and his younger new baby sister had died, and then they were sort of, there was this father and he had a brother, and a week later, after that had happened, his dog had run out into the street and was killed. And then just a month or 6 weeks later than that, maybe 2 months, I can't remember the exact timing, but it was just a few months, his brother contracted meningitis and died very quickly. And so, and the father was really caught up in his own story of grief. It was really unavailable to this young boy. And so here was this young boy, he'd come to us and he'd lost everything and everyone that mattered to him in his life. He was being taken care of by more distant relatives at that point. And we thought, oh my God, how are we going to help this young boy? Do we have, it was in the relatively early stages of our own development. And he came to our group and he walked into the children's support group on the very first night. And we've got, you have to imagine this room, there's murals on the walls and there's a circle in the center of the room filled with bright colored pillows for the kids and the volunteer facilitators to sit on. And there's stuffed animals that are all puppets, very good sized, animals filled up in the circle. And but over in the corner was this stack of oversized pillows that somebody had donated to us. And he walked into the room, he saw that stack of pillows, he went over to the pillows and he crawled underneath them so you couldn't even see his body. And, okay, let him just do what he needs to do. We're going to allow him to be as he is. We're going to trust this process. And so the kids all got in a circle like they were all trained to do. Kids had been there a while. He was the new one in the room. And we passed the talking stick, and each kid would share their name and whatever they wanted to about their story. And when the talking stick passed by him, going from one kid to another in the circle, his arm reached out from those pillows and grabbed the talking stick. And so, even though he wasn't visible to us, we knew he was listening. And he held onto that talking stick for a second, and then he passed it on to the next kid with his arm still sticking out, his body invisible, hidden beneath the pillows. And so he did this week after week. And then one week, he grabbed the talking stick with his hand from beneath the pillows, and he took the talking stick with him under the pillows. And then we heard this sound that sounded like a fart. And he had stuck his hand underneath his armpit and made that sound, that kids can do. And everybody, the room just busted up laughing. We all just died laughing. And then this talking stick came out from under the pillows and he passed it on to the next kid. So that was his fun thing to do for several sessions. And we just let him do his process. And this went on for several months. I want to say maybe 4 months. And our sessions were every other week. And then one day, he emerged from the pillows and came out and sat down on one of the empty pillows and held the talking stick in his hand and in almost a whisper said, "I miss my mom. I miss my mom." And in one moment, he finally went to the thing that was at the heart of his grief. And that day, in the art session of the evening, he drew a picture of his mom and of his dog. And so, you know, here we were, you know, we had to trust the process. And we did. We did trust the process. Well, thanks so much for listening. I appreciate it. And for you to know, the name of the book is called Being There for Someone in Grief, Essential Lessons for Supporting Someone Grieving from Death, Loss, and Trauma by yours truly, Mariana Cacciatore. Next week, I hope you'll join us when we'll be talking to Greg Welsh, CEO of Organic Valley Farms. They're a national cooperative owned by family farmers. They began back in 1988 when family farms were on the brink of extinction. And creating a cooperative helped them to save their farms. And instead of folding, they actually flourished. So from the start, they based all of their decisions on the health and welfare of people, animals, and the earth. And that has paid off. Today, Organic Valley is the number one source of organic milk in the nation, and they champion a system of farming that supports family farms, defends the ethical and humane treatment of farm animals. It benefits the environment, and it gives consumer high-quality organic food. It doesn't get much better than that. So join us next week for an enlightening conversation with Greg Welsh. And finally, if you can find a place in your heart and pocketbook to support our small nonprofit, Bread for the Journey, we would be so grateful. Go to our website at breadforthejourney.org. You can learn more about our work and you can donate there. If everyone pitches in a little bit or a lot, we can change the world. So I close with, may all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings be free. See you next week.
We hope our program inspired you this week. Please join Mariana Cacciatore for another edition of Bread for the Journey next Saturday at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.